Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm an author and educator dedicated to empowering people to make informed food choices, to debunking myths about veganism, to being a voice for animals, and to giving people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, and my newest book, On Being Vegan, Reflections on a Compassionate Life. The newest book is available as an ebook right now, and very shortly it will be out in paperback. And I'll devote more time to talking about the book in the next episode. But as the book was inspired by this podcast, this whole podcast, not this particular episode, but by my podcast, I thought you would all like to know that you can get it now, right now, right now. And you can download it to whatever e-reader you use, Kindle, Nook, Kobo. You can even download it to your computer. You don't have to have a specific e-reader. You can download it to an iBook, an iPhone, an iPad, whatever smartphone you have. So you can go to my website at compassionatecook.com, and under books, you can find it, and it lists all the different places. And I would be so honored if you would read it, if you would let others know about it, if you would add a review at online bookstores, on Goodreads, if you tweet about it and Facebook about it. I'm really proud of it, and I really hope you like it. On Being Vegan, Reflections on a Compassionate Life, the first volume of my new Joyful Vegan series. I'm also the creator and host of the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, which gives you everything you need to make the transition healthfully, joyfully, and deliciously. And yes, if you're already vegan, you will get a ton out of this program as well. You can also gift it to the vegan curious in your life. You can check that out at 30dayveganchallenge.com. And as I said, you can check out all my work at my website, compassionatecook.com. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook, and I hope you do. Twitter.com/Patrick Goudreau and at Facebook.com/compassionatecooks. I think that's how it reads. And of course, before we get started with today's episode, first and foremost, I would like to thank my amazing platinum members, James Killen of Incentive Personal Training in Australia. That's personal-training.com.au. Anonymous in Norway, you know who you are. Grace Rodriguez, Tim Anderson, David Cabrera, and Alexander Gray. Alexander Gray Associates, which you can find at alexandergray.com. And they actually have a really exciting event coming up with Jenny Brown from Woodstock Animal Sanctuary. So go to alexandergray.com to find out more about that. Peter and Eric of Peace Food Cafe in New York City. That's peacefoodcafe.com. And their second location just opened up downtown. And I will be there at Peace Food at their new downtown location on May 7th, 2013. And I will be there for a meet and greet and a book signing and dinner. And so please join me if you are in New York City or in the surrounding area. That's peacefoodcafe.com. Thank you to Chris Hanna of Propagandi in Canada. It's propagandi.com. That's propagandhi.com. And Anonymous in Melbourne, Australia. You know who you are. And thank you. Thanks to all of my platinum members. So grateful for all of you. And thank you to all of the new gold members, Otilia Horntvedt in Sweden, Lynette Cowie and her family in Qatar, Chelsea Collins in Australia, and Jason Biggins and Natalie Foley in the US. How is that for an international audience? All around the world, people are listening to this podcast. It's so amazing. I will be reading their letters, the new gold members' letters, in the next episode. But as I promised in the previous podcast episode, I need to read some of the letters from the gold members I thanked in that episode. And I will continue to read new gold members' letters in subsequent episodes. So if you don't hear your letter, it's coming, I promise. We need to do another love letters episode already. It's just amazing. So this is from renewing gold member Stephanie Helgeson, who wrote, "Dear Colleen, I've been listening to your podcast, reading your essays, and cooking from your amazing recipes for several years now, and I wanted to write to say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. When I found you, I was a lacto-ovo vegetarian making steady progress toward a vegan life. Unfortunately, I had bought into the idea that veganism was about some sort of absolute perfection and purity, and it was wearing me down. I felt guilty for not interviewing restaurants on the precise contents of my dinner roll and for eating Cheerios, even though I know they are fortified with vitamin D. Some vitamin D comes from animal products. Every time I slipped, quote unquote, and ate a bit of cheese or a cookie, I felt I had completely failed and considered giving it up entirely. I was so focused on the idea of veganism instead of really examining why it was important to me that I had no defenses against even the most ridiculous anti-vegan arguments. After reading The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is Michael Pollan's book, for those who don't know it, I was half convinced that my vegetarianism was inconsiderate, antisocial, and even disrespectful to animals. I could be heard saying with increasing frequency, I should probably start eating meat again. Then a dear friend recommended your podcast. I think the actual conversation went something like this. Heather, Colleen Patrick Goudreau's new cookbook just came out and it's amazing. Me, who? Heather, you know, from the Vegetarian Food for Thought podcast. Me, the what? Heather, go listen now. So I did, and it was exactly what I needed. You spoke of veganism as compassion, and I realized why I had been struggling. I was looking at veganism itself as the goal and berating myself every time I fell short. When compassion is my goal, I can't help but succeed. You said, don't do nothing because you can't do everything. Did you know these are magic words? Giving myself permission to do less was a huge relief. It also, paradoxically, allowed me to do more. I started to take real joy in trying new foods, tweaking an old family recipe, or treating myself to a pair of non-leather shoes instead of focusing on all the things I still wasn't, quote-unquote, getting right. Interestingly, this idea has spilled into other areas of my life. I've taken on a more active teaching role at work, finally realizing that I don't have to be an expert to share my knowledge with a student or resident. Last year, I ran a marathon. I couldn't run a marathon when I started training, but I could run 2 miles, so I did. Like I said, magic words. So again, thank you. Thank you for helping me become a happier, healthier, more compassionate person. Thank you for reminding me to extend compassion to myself. Thank you for recommending O Hazard Balthazar, which is the Bresson film I've recommended. For those who don't know that episode, it's from the episode called The Burden of Burroughs. And Robert Bresson is the director of an amazing film called O Hazard Balthazar, which makes me cry every time. And thank you for your marvelous mushroom risotto recipe, which is indescribably delicious. With gratitude, Stephanie. Thank you so much, Stephanie. That is incredible. I am so moved. And I do think they're magic words. I really have witnessed what those words have done for people and exactly what you say. You think it would give you license to do less, but it actually gives you license to do more, or it gives you the flexibility to do more. It's just a beautiful thing. So I'm so glad they were magical for you. From Gold member Nicole Evall, who I believe I thanked in the last episode. Thank you, Nicole. And here's her letter. Dear Colleen, thank you for all that you do. You are such a great inspiration and role model for us to follow. I recently adopted the vegan lifestyle after being a vegetarian for 5 years because of you. Somehow cooking more after I was married made me question what I was actually making. I feel so stupid saying this now, but it wasn't until then that I realized chicken was actually chicken. Talk about animal meat being ingrained into our culture. I just ate less and less meat until one day on my way to work, I passed a local farm with adorable baby cows galloping outside and said, "That's it. I'm vegetarian from now on." I mean, look at their sweet eyes. I hadn't thought about going vegan until I found your cookbooks about a year ago and then saw you speaking on the web and at the Seed event last spring in New York City. I had no idea about dairy and the mistreatment of animals. You're an amazing speaker. I was in awe because I occasionally have to speak in public at work and I just fear it. I saw your passion and it came through in your eloquent way. My husband and I are now vegan for just about a year because of you. Then you created the 30-Day Vegan Challenge. You helped us find all these great brands and new recipes to try. What a great program this is for anyone trying to find their way. I love the vegan table and the joy of vegan baking because every single recipe I've made from these books is excellent. In fact, I couldn't bake before I started making your recipes, but now, like some miracle from God, it's so simple and delicious. My husband agrees. He says that Colleen really knows what she's doing as we bite into yet another one of your delicious brownies, eyes rolling into the back of our heads. Oh, how wonderful. This is great. Your words, don't do nothing because you can't do everything, do something, anything, really hit home with me. I didn't even plan this. I swear I didn't plan this. I frequently quote you to my friends and colleagues, and when I do, they hear it. They hear the message. It's so cool. It's baby steps for most people, and this helps open the door. Some have started to eat less meat and dairy. Thanks for giving us your words to share with others so that we can help make a difference. I hope I get to meet you in person one day. Your neighbors and friends are so lucky to have a strong, intelligent, and caring person in their lives. Now, in my spare time between two jobs, I started to blog about the vegan transition, and I'm working to create more vegan options in the lovely cafeteria where I work. If there's anything I can do to help you on your path, please let me know. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Sincerely, Nicole. So wonderful, Nicole. That is just awesome. It's just incredible. I'm so grateful for you, Nicole and Stephanie. And thank you so much for sharing this with me and allowing me to share it with my listeners. And more letters are to come, I promise. And please do remember that this podcast is 100% listener supported. Without you and you and you, yes, I'm looking at you, I would not be able to do this work. And I mean it. Everyone who supports this podcast makes it possible for me to continue. So thank you to everyone. Thank you for becoming a member or just making a donation, which you can do at compassionatecook.com under podcast. Click on support our podcast. And thank you also to Eric Bright, our new podcast engineer, who now saves my life by editing the podcast. And hopefully Eric did not edit that out. Don't edit that out, Eric. You can't do that. So I appreciate your help, Eric. And I appreciate everyone who listens. So here we go on to today's topic, the process of awakening. Despite the fact that compassion is a guiding principle in all the world's religions and secular philosophies, and despite the fact that most people consider themselves compassionate and kind, the primary message we receive by the time we're adults is that compassion is acceptable as long as it's conditional, as long as it's selective and reserved only for certain groups, for certain species. We're taught to love our household dogs and cats and rabbits, but we're also taught that other domesticated animals, such as pigs and cows and chickens and turkeys and even rabbits, are here for us to eat. We even compartmentalize the dogs and the cats, right? If we say that they're useful for experimental research, then we'll allow that. So we even create splits within these species. And so this profound childhood compassion that we once felt toward animals gets put to sleep in favor of the pleasure and convenience of eating burgers and milkshakes and dismembered fried legs and wings. We go along our merry way, eating everything that walks or swims or flies, until a fateful moment when we become awake, when we become vegan. Now, that's a very condensed way of talking about the process we go through. And of course, there is much unspoken in that short little paragraph. But I do believe that the process of becoming vegan is the process of reclaiming our true compassion and becoming reawakened to it. That's why I have so much hope, because I believe it's in everyone. It's just lying dormant. And I think understanding this phenomenon of blocked compassion and understanding this process of becoming reawakened to it is the key to inspiring it in others and remaining awake once we open our eyes. So I'm going to talk about this process of awakening in today's episode. But before I do, I want to talk about what happens once we become awake, once we become vegan. Truthfully, though, the process of becoming awake is a powerful one. It is a powerful one. Our stories don't end once we become awake. In the fairy tale archetype, the story ends once the heroine or hero is reawakened, right? And they live happily ever after. But for us, once we become awake, once we become vegan, it's at that point that our stories just begin. And what happens at that moment of awakening is so powerful. The moment when you're compelled to become vegan is what we call it, when you feel your eyes open, when you feel a veil lifted, when you feel that sense of clarity, it's really, really powerful and it's really unexpected. Seeing the world through a completely different lens, you experience what literally feels like a rebirth. You feel naked. You feel vulnerable. You feel new. You feel authentic. You feel raw. You feel liberated and you feel bruised and battered, having come through what feels like a birth canal. So leading up to becoming vegan is the process of awakening. But once we're awakened, there is so much more that takes place. And I don't think it's really talked about that much. I mean, I talk about it a lot, as you know, through my podcasts, through my talks, and I write about it in my books, but I never laid it out this way. So after years of thinking about this, day in and day out, and after years of gathering stories from people all around the world who have gone through this process, I've identified 10 stages that we each go through once we become vegan. And in subsequent podcast episodes, I'm going to tackle each one in a formal, detailed way. And you, my amazing podcast listeners, are the first to witness this content, which will be the basis of an upcoming book tentatively called From Consumption to Compassion, 10 Stages You Go Through When You Stop Eating Animals and What You Need to Know to Stay Hopeful and Joyful. It's a tentative title, but that's the gist. And the reason I'm so excited about this is because I truly believe that knowing that these stages are real is crucial to feeling normal, crucial to understanding why people react the way they do when you tell them you're vegan, and crucial to living in this world as a proud, joyful vegan who can effectively advocate for the animals and on behalf of a compassionate ethic. And even more critical, I think, is that in recognizing and understanding these stages, vegans, especially new vegans, see that it is indeed a process and that though the stages aren't necessarily linear, you can definitely recycle through them as time goes on, you can definitely get stuck in a certain stage. And getting stuck in one of the stages and not understanding that you can and will, if you so choose, move through it to the next stage can have dire consequences. If you get stuck in a stage, there can be consequences. What I'm saying is that through identifying these stages, we may have a key to understanding why people go back to sleep, why people who have been vegan can justify going back to eating animals and or their secretions again. My hope is that in identifying these stages, I'll be able to give voice to validate, to give a name to the process we all go through. And in doing so, help vegans understand that it's totally normal to have the reactions we do, to help vegans feel that they're not alone, to help them name something that is a new feeling or a new experience or a new perception, and to help them move through the stages in a productive, constructive, effective, and joyful way, while embracing the fact that living fully awake can be painful sometimes, but it need not weigh us down. So I'm very excited. I just got goosebumps. I'm very excited to reveal these stages to you and address them in detail in subsequent episodes. So here they are, just revealing this for the first time with you. Stage one. Now, again, we're going to talk about the process of awakening, and this is what happens once you have the epiphany. Once you have the moment where you become awake and you become vegan, this is what follows. Stage one is validation or consumption of information. This is the stage just after your awakening when you say, I can't believe this is happening. And you read every book and watch every video to validate that it's real, that what's happening to the animals is real. You're looking for validation in every way. This is the stage where you start truly investigating how to eat healthfully and you legitimately ask where you get your protein and your calcium, et cetera. You really want to know because it's not an option to consume animals at all. And this is when you explore all the food options that you never noticed before. This is the stage when you do the 30-day vegan challenge because you're ready to do it and you want to have all the right information you need. So this is validation, voracious consumption of information. This is the first stage. Stage two is guilt. Now you heard some of this in Stephanie's letter. So this is the stage when you process everything you've just discovered and you ask, first of all, how could I not have known? How could I have been part of this? You feel guilty for having participated in violence against animals. You also, as Stephanie talked about, experience guilt at not being a perfect vegan or guilt about eating something by mistake that wasn't vegan and so on. Guilt. This is the stage when I talk about forgiving ourselves for what we did in the past and didn't know we were contributing to, and accepting ourselves as the imperfect people we are. So by the way, throughout each stage, I'm not only going to identify and name the stage, but I'll also talk about ways, as I said, to move through it. And so kind of solutions to the challenges we have when we're in each stage. Stage three is coming out. This is the stage when we tell our friends and family that we're vegan. This is the stage when we have the fear of losing loved ones, of hurting their feelings, of not knowing how to deal with the holidays, of dealing with and understanding the reaction of family and friends and why they might take it personally. This is the coming out stage. Stage four is the evangelizing stage. This is when we're so justifiably excited about this newfound awareness and this newfound consciousness and compassion that we talk about nothing else. This is where we desperately want everyone around us to see what we now see, to learn what we learned, to change as we've changed. At this stage, I talk about walking the line between being joyful and confident and excited about our compassion and consciousness and not shying away from our enthusiasm for it, but also understanding the importance of planting seeds rather than trying to get someone to change. Stage five, this is the stage of grief and anger and sorrow. This is the stage when we're really truly aware of how large this problem is. It kind of penetrated inside of us. We really understand it. We've absorbed it and we feel overwhelmed by it. This is when we ask, can I really make a difference? This is when we lament about all the people around us who seem not to care. And when we feel frustrated that none of the people who heard our evangelizing made any change in their diet at all. And so this is the stage where I talk about how to use this anger for good, how to have compassion for all, and how to cope with and move past the grief and the anger. It's also when I talk about the value of time, of understanding and trusting that given time, the people around us do start to move, they do start to change. It just may not be when we want it to happen, and it just may not be because of us, though we can be certain that we'll have planted seeds, but it might not happen because of us. Okay, that's stage five. That's the grief, that's the anger and the sorrow. Stage six, this is connection and community. This is when we understand the value of, or when we crave to be part of, a community of like-minded people, of being with people who speak the same language, so we feel connected rather than isolated or alienated. For this stage, I talk about the number of different ways we can find and be part of a community of like-minded folks and the importance of having community, even if for right now it's online, just the importance of being connected with like-minded people. Stage seven is communicating. This is finding your voice. This is when you begin to get more comfortable in your own vegan skin and begin to find your voice, including how to speak to people who push back when you tell them you're vegan, or who are hostile or passive aggressive or disrespectful to you. This is where we learn the importance of finding your voice, being proud and unapologetic about living compassionately, and learning effective communication skills to enable us to be ambassadors of compassion. So stage seven is communication. Stage eight is expansion of awareness and skills. Now, I love this stage because this is where we, in looking at the world through a new lens, challenge old ideas and notions, learn new skills, recognize the connections between this issue and other social justice issues. This is the expansion of awareness, right? And we connect the issues around farmed animals. We see it with all animals, the exploitation of all animals in our society. And we realize that this is endemic, that it's not just around farmed animals, that this is a much deeper issue that needs to be addressed from a perspective of exploitation of animals and seeing them as here for us. I mean, we make these connections. So this is the expansion of awareness, and it's the expansion of skills, right? This is when our skills and our awareness are deepened, where we have more profound and intimate relationships with humans and non-human animals. And we start to recognize the physical, tangible health benefits that comes with leaving behind animal products. This is the stage where we buy our first food processor or high-powered blender, or we garden for the first time, or we try new foods or cuisines or restaurants. This is when we learn how expansive it is to live unconditionally, compassionately. Stage nine is advocacy. Having experienced all these benefits and having found our own voice, we begin to ask, where do I fit in? How can I help? What skills do I have that I can use to be part of the solution? What's my contribution? And stage 10 is integration and adaptation. This is when we feel the fullness of who we are, the pride and liberation and joy and freedom of being a joyful vegan. It's not that we didn't feel this, you know, earlier on in stage one. It's just we embrace it. It's who we are. It's how people define us. It dictates everything we do and say and every decision we make. We fully embrace it. We fully embrace this amazing and sometimes painful way of living. We happily adapt accordingly. We know that if we're going to go to a restaurant that's not vegan, we're going to have to, you know, call in advance or have fewer menu options. But we do this happily because of how right this feels. We may even change careers. This is adaptation. We may change our lives in a more radical way. And we're very comfortable and proud in our vegan skin. We become the attraction and inspiration for others. So that's the gist of the 10 stages. And though you've probably heard some of the content in different contexts and mediums of my work, I will be addressing these issues in this context in subsequent episodes. So if you've written to me about how to cope with the overwhelming sense of sadness and sorrow for the animals who are suffering, I'll address that in the context of stage 5, for instance, and so on. Okay, so I'm very excited about this. I think there's really something to this here, and I'd love your thoughts about it. Okay, so now, in order to really fully understand those stages of what happens once you become awake, we first have to understand the process of getting to the awakening, right? I mean, if we're talking about an awakening, the implication is that you're asleep. And so first, I think it's helpful to talk about the ways we stay asleep and the ways we fight to stay asleep and are taught to stay asleep. So today we're going to focus on the process of awakening. What happens as we lead up to the actual awakening, the actual epiphany? Now, as you've heard me say before, I do believe children come into this world innately compassionate and empathetic, which are qualities we encourage and foster. I've told my own story in other episodes, in particular, I think the one called Resensitizing Children. One of the things I talk about is that we learn from animals. Animals are our teachers. Think of all the books and games and videos that we use animals for to teach children how to count and how to read and how to spell. And then think of all the ways in which adults use images of animals to instill feelings of peace and joy and security. Society recognizes that when a child is kind and gentle toward an animal, toward an other, it's a positive sign about the emotional and mental state of that child. Kindness to an animal is one of the barometers we use to measure mental health, and we're justifiably concerned when a child is not kind to an animal. It tends to indicate that something is wrong. It shows lack of compassion, a lack of empathy. It's not that we don't have to guide children to treating animals gently, teaching them that it hurts if you pull their tail, for instance, but the point is, we don't emerge into this world bloodthirsty and cruel. If someone does, we recognize that as a problem. It's the anomaly. It's not the norm. And I'm actually just thinking, I'm going to quote a couple things from Richard III, which are relevant to our discussion today. And I just remembered that he talks about coming into this world, you know, just kind of deformed. And it doesn't just mean physically. He comes into this world kind of as a monster. This idea that someone comes into the world as a monster is an anomaly. It's not how most of us come into this world. Now, to be clear, I do believe we all have the capacity to be violent and cruel, but we have an equal capacity to be fiercely compassionate. And I believe our pull toward the latter is stronger than the pull toward the former. I also believe that compassion is what we're born with. I believe we come into this world innately compassionate. Now, when we do, the adults around us encourage that compassion, but then it's slowly put to sleep through the messages of the status quo that tell us that it's normal, natural, and necessary to take a page out of my good friend Melanie Joy's book on carnism, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. We're told that it's normal, natural, and necessary, and so we begin to compartmentalize our compassion. We begin to compartmentalize the animals into those we love and live with and those who are valuable only because of how they can serve us. We eat them, we consume what comes out of their bodies, we use them, we make them perform for us, and we receive the message from all around us that this is okay. Tradition, social norms, family pressure, slick advertising campaigns, government subsidies, marketing messages masked as public service announcements all successfully squelch our once fierce, once unconditional compassion, put it to sleep and suppress it and contain it. But there is good news. The vault this compassion is relegated to is not watertight. It's porous. And as a result, our compassion is always leaking out somehow. It's always trying to escape. It's always trying to be free. And this can be seen in a number of ways. through the guilt we feel when we eat animals and their secretions, through the excuses and the justifications we make to feel better about it, through the labels we stick on these things to make us feel better about it, through the denial we choose this denial in order to pretend that we're not hurting anybody, through the passive aggressiveness or the full-blown aggressiveness we feel toward anyone who threatens to break us out of our protective comfort zone, where we're desensitized and numb to our compassion, but we're not inconvenienced by our conscience, right? That's the whole idea, is that we just kind of create this wall and this comfort zone around us, but we do what we tell ourselves so that we're not inconvenienced by this conscience. Our conscience is where our compassion tries to reach us, but we're taught to ignore that too. After all, as is said by one of the hired killers in Richard III, conscience is but a word that cowards used, devised at first to keep the strong in awe. In other words, we're taught that we're weak if we listen to our conscience, if we are fully conscious and fully compassionate. That's for sissies. That's for children, right? Compassion is, oh, she's really nice. She's a really sweet child. She loves animals. How lovely, how sweet. Or imagine that as an adult. She's really sweet. She's so kind. She takes her compassion to the extreme a little bit. She loves pigs and she loves, you know, she's vegan and everything, but she's still a nice person, right? Like there's this compassionate extreme we could have, you know, compassion is for children. And we see this played out all the time. Animal-based meat is for real men. You're weak if you eat only plants. You're sentimental if you care about animals as an adult, especially if those animals are not just dogs and cats, but pigs and chickens. Squelch that compassion. Out damn spot, as Lady Macbeth pleaded. Out damn compassion. All Lady Macbeth saw on her hands was blood. All she saw was her own guilt. Out, I say, she said. Will these hands never be clean, she said. If we can just squelch our compassion and our conscience, that's what we're kind of hoping for. If we could just wipe the guilt and the blood off of our hands, we would be fine to go about our business eating who we want with no one to make us feel bad. And the truth is, we can't escape from the guilt of it as long as we're still participating in it. Here's the smell of blood still, says Lady Macbeth. All the perfumes in Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. And indeed, it is so for us. So our compassion seeps out as we try to deny our complicity, but it stays locked up just enough to enable us to consume animals and whatever comes out of their bodies, while still perceiving ourselves as compassionate, kind, thoughtful, nonviolent people. Now, if you've read Richard III, which I have to tell you is my favorite Shakespeare play, he's my favorite Shakespeare character. I think he's one of the greatest characters ever written in the English canon, in my opinion. We see that we're not so different from him in that we have a perception of ourselves, and then there's the truth of who we are. And it's that battle between these two things that's always taking place, I would argue. It's why we feel so bad when we're confronted with the truth of eating animals. Richard is plagued with ghosts at the climax of Act 5, who, quote, sit heavy in Richard's soul and who decry him as bloody and guilty, ordering him to guiltily awake. Awake, the ghosts urge him, as he complains that his quote-unquote conscience hath a thousand several tongues. And that's what it feels like for us, right? While our conscience is urging us to awaken, we're taught that we have to fight hard against it, and we have allies that help us fight against it. And it's fear that drives us. It's fear that wants to keep us asleep. It's fear that drove Richard III to do what he did, and it's fear that drives us to do what we do. Because having an awakening is exactly what we don't want when we're asleep. It's the worst thing. That's what we're most afraid of. Don't tell me, I don't want to know, which many of us have said and which many of us now hear. It's just another way of saying, I know this information you're about to give me or show me or tell me is about to change me. I know it's going to change me. It's going to change who I am and what I believe in and how I behave and what I eat and what I buy and how I interact with this world and the people in it. And I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid to be different than who I am now because this is all I know. I don't know what that's going to look like if I change. So if you please, I'd like to stay nice and safe and secure here in my dreamland of denial and not wake up. I mean, it's the fear we have in waking a sleepwalker, right? The consequences are so scary, mostly because they're unknown. You don't know what you could trigger. You don't know what will happen once you wake them up. And so it's much safer for all of us if you just stay asleep. Now, I know I'm not doing an assessment of Richard III here, but I think in literary terms, literally, so I can't help myself. But the parallel is here at the end of Act Five. So this is this idea of, you know, don't wake me, this struggle between who I am right now in the world and who I'm afraid to be or I'm afraid to face. This is what Richard is grappling with at the end of Act Five. He's grappling with his conscience, but he doesn't know how to separate himself from the guilt he feels. He doesn't know who he is or who he'll be if he does indeed become awakened to his conscience. He says, "What do I fear? Myself? There's none else by. Richard loves Richard. That is I, and I. Is there a murderer here? No. Yes, I am. Then fly. What? From myself? Great reason why, lest I revenge. What? Myself upon myself?" And I think we experience this too, this fear, this kind of bipolar conflict within ourselves. You know, who am I? Who am I going to be? How can I put this upon myself? Now, we may not phrase it as eloquently as Shakespeare did, but I think that's what's going on here. Now, of course, it's not just the sleeper who fights against waking up, but so does everyone around us, right? Our waking up is a threat to everyone and everything around us, partially for the same reason, from the perspective of those closest to us. They're invested in who we are at that moment. And what will it mean if you change? Who will you be? Will I still know you? Will I still understand you? Will we still be compatible? Who will I become? Will I have to change? Will you judge me if I don't? Will you love me anymore? Those are some pretty serious and real concerns that people around us have. And then, of course, there's the immense profit gained by those who rely on our ignorance to sell us the cheap and yet so costly products, the animal meat industry, the dairy industry, the egg industry, the cheese industry, the leather industry, the wool industry, the down feather cashmere and silk industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the animal byproduct industry, the zoo industry, the circus industry, the animals and entertainment industry, pretty much everyone who banks on our not knowing, not seeing, and not caring about the victims of these trades has a vested interest and an investment in us staying asleep. Because once we become awake, they lose us as customers. And of course, the government has a stake in this too, because as with the industries just named, it's all about money and power. And since these industries line the pockets of politicians who want to stay in power and who want to have their pockets lined, they want us to stay asleep too. Is it a conspiracy? Yes, of course it is. All of these things conspire, literally breathe life into, that's what conspire means, literally breathe life into us staying asleep. Are they all in it together, secretly figuring out ways to keep us asleep? No. But since each one has that very same agenda, keeping us asleep, they each do it in their own way, consciously and unconsciously working to keep us snoring away in our complacency. And as I've said before, because they're aware of how easy it is and how possible it is for us to learn the truth, they work really, really, really hard and spend a lot of money to keep us asleep. That's why I say the harder you see the industry or individuals, I'll say the industry, I mean the animal exploitation industries, the harder you see them and the harder you see individuals fighting against the truth, the more threatened they are. That's kind of the weird good news, is it indicates how wrong they know they are and how right they know you are. All of the legislation that's being proposed and succeeding in the U.S. to make it illegal, to make it a felony to film or photograph on farms and ranches is all about fear. The fear they have because they know that once people see and know the truth, that's it. Their world comes crumbling down. These are the so-called anti-whistleblower bills or ag-gag bills you've probably heard of. Now, in the recent past, the agriculture industry introduced anti-whistleblower bills in Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, New York, and Tennessee. And most of these bills failed. Not all of them, but most of them failed thanks to a strong public outcry. In 2013, 10 states have introduced anti-whistleblower bills. Arkansas, California, Indiana, Nebraska, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Wyoming, and Vermont. And I encourage you to get involved in this issue. It's something you really can get involved in. You have a voice. And I encourage you to learn more about this by Googling it, AgGag bills, or checking out one of my go-to resources for this, which is the amazing Will Potter, his amazing website and blog and work at greenisthenewred.com. And when the average consumer hears about this, they're disgusted by it. So I really encourage you to get involved in this. I think this is something where you really can get your voice heard and get your friends' voices heard and ask them to get involved. Everyone recognizes that the industries clearly have something to hide because of these bills. But how different are these ag gag laws from what individuals do to keep the truth from sinking in, right? I mean, it's like compassion gagging, right? I mean, think of it literally. The animal exploitation industries are scared to death that people will see and of course, be moved by the inherent cruelty in keeping and killing animals. And so they're quite literally trying to put gags on the advocates, the truth seekers, the truth tellers, quite literally trying to seal the cap on the camera lens and stuff a rag into the mouths of those who are witnesses. In other words, they want to criminalize the act of revealing the truth. And we as individuals do the same thing. I'm specifically referring to those of us who are comfortably numb, those of us who are asleep, and along comes a vegan, a witness, a truth teller, an advocate who wants to ruin all our fun, who wants to throw back the curtain like Dorothy, or really it was Toto, in The Wizard of Oz. And they don't criminalize vegans, though I think some would like to criminalize vegans. Our friends and coworkers, colleagues, family members, acquaintances, neighbors can certainly demonize vegans. In other words, it's not the truth that's ugly, right? It's those who reveal the truth. It's the messengers. The messengers are the problem. So kill the messenger and you kill the truth, right? Kill the messenger and you kill the problem is the hope. Stupid vegans, never letting anyone have any fun, showing up talking about cruelty and death and violence. It's them. The vegans are the problem. It's their fault. If they would just go away, everything would be fine. And so we work really hard to stay in our stupor. We blame the messenger. I say we blame the messenger. I mean, these are the non-vegans who, you know, who want to stay asleep are blaming the messenger. And this is where these excuses come in. You know, what about the people in the mountains of Tibet? They can't be vegan, so neither will I. My blood type is such that I have to eat animals, so darn it, as much as I'd like to stop eating them, I'm just built this way. Animals are here for us, so I'm doing them a favor by helping them fulfill their role on this earth, right? I mean, just all these excuses that we, these spells that we tell ourselves, these spells that keep us asleep, and these spells that everyone agrees to. Yes, that's true. The animals are here for us. Everyone's kind of walking around in this drone, right? All of these excuses, all of this money, all of this at play to keep us asleep. And yet, amazingly, despite every excuse we make and every myth we perpetuate, despite everyone around us who shields us from the truth, despite all the companies who spend billions of dollars on marketing and PR, and despite all of the bills that are trying to get passed to stop the truth from coming to the public, we still wake up. It's pretty remarkable if you think about it, and yet it's not so remarkable at all. It's not remarkable because in the end, the truth is more powerful than greed, and our compassion is more powerful than fear, literally. Think about that for a moment. Truth with a capital T is working just as hard all the time to be recognized, to be seen and heard. Our own compassion is constantly trying to ooze its way into our consciousness such that despite all of the mechanisms in place to keep us asleep, we slowly begin to awaken. And even though we often talk about the final thing that wakes us, that final epiphany, which I'll talk about in a minute, things are at play all the time to force us awake. It's like a slow drip feed, like an IV drip. Little by little, things start to stir. And this is why I say it's so important for advocates to understand the power of planting seeds, the power of just contributing to that drip feed in others. Sometimes it's an overt crisis that stirs things up. It might be a health-related crisis. It might be spiritual. We might get a health scare and begin to understand the ill effects of consuming animals and their secretions on our bodies and on our minds and on our spirits. We might just be curious about cutting down our consumption of animals. We might start up yoga and question, how can I be committed to ahimsa, to nonviolence, while I'm still eating animals, right? So things start to stir. Little seeds get planted. Little drips of compassion kind of seep into our consciousness. And so cracks start to reveal themselves. Remember I said that this vault that we put the compassion in is porous, and these cracks start to reveal themselves. Remember Allison's story from the Love Letters episode? Do you remember this? Allison did a report for school, and she stopped eating pigs. And time went by, and she did another report, and she stopped eating chickens. Her mother told her to stop doing reports because she knew that the more that was revealed to her daughter, the more her daughter would change. And that's what she was afraid of, right? Her mother reacted the same way so many of us do. Don't do away with killing animals for consumption. Do away with reports. Stop with the reports. Do away with those things that reveal the truth. But the cracks continued, destroying the foundation of ignorance. And eventually, as she tells it, Allison listened to my podcast and she became vegan. You know, there were several steps in that process. Now, those cracks that reveal themselves can also make us very uncomfortable. We've been fighting so hard against the truth, against our own unconditional compassion. The light that shines through those cracks can make us a little nervous. Like it's a taste of what's to come, and we think we can just stop there. Like, okay, cracks came in. I've made a couple changes. I'm going to start, you know, just making a couple steps, but I'm not going to go too far, right? So we start to kind of bargain with ourselves. We make deals. We do just enough to feel like we're doing something, kind of like what Allison talked about. She stopped eating one animal at a time. And many of us do this. You feel like you can't take it all in. You can't awaken completely. You feel that you can't change all at once. And so you do what you think reflects the enlightenment that those cracks reveal and reflect. But you only do so much so that it's not too uncomfortable. You stop eating only pigs or only quote unquote red meat. You buy only quote unquote humane meat or quote unquote free range eggs or quote unquote organic cow's milk. And we pat ourselves on the back for letting a little light in. But we also secure our foundation a little more so that hopefully no more of those pesky cracks emerge. The problem is once the cracks start, they keep coming. And it's really hard to patch them up. So whether we're aware of it or not, and whether it's several months or several years later after those cracks start to open, we take another step toward our epiphany and subsequent awakening. We go on a quest. And as a result, we have an encounter. Sometimes we're not even aware that we're on a quest. Sometimes it's very conscious. We may just start asking new questions. We may check out some websites. I hear from a lot of people who find my podcast just out of curiosity, but they say that they weren't looking to change, right? But something is compelling them to come and look to a podcast called Vegetarian Food for Thought. We may read some new books or, you know, we just decide we're going to cut back on the amount of animal-based meat we eat or the dairy that we eat. And so sometimes, and in some ways, we don't even know what we're looking for while we're on this quest. We just know that we need something different. We know that something isn't right. We know that something just isn't working, and we just know that. That's like all we know, and that's how we kind of start on this little quest. And we know that these cracks are compelling us to seek out something new. And so we carry on this quest that leads us to an encounter, and that's the encounter. So that might be the podcast. So you're kind of searching things out. You're curious about this and that. You're questioning what's vegetarian, what's this or whatever, health, is it better? And you have an encounter. And that counter can be with a person, could be with a podcast, as I said, it could be a particular book or a video, it could be an encounter with an animal. And it's ultimately through this encounter that we have our epiphany. Everything leads up to this moment. Everything leads up to this wake-up call. Literally, that's what it is. It's the thing that jars us awake. The cracks are no longer cracks because the cracks are gone. Because the wall is gone. The wall is completely destroyed. You're no longer whispering or tiptoeing around. You're completely awake. The truth is crystal clear. The veil is lifted completely from your eyes. And finally, effortlessly, organically, you're compelled to act. You become vegan. So that's the process of awakening. We fight to stay asleep, and everyone around us conspires to keep us asleep. Despite our efforts, cracks begin to appear. We make bargains to do just enough to stay sleeping, but still feel like we're honoring those cracks. And despite ourselves, or what the end will bring, we don't even know what it's going to look like in the end. We consciously or unconsciously go on a quest through which we have an encounter. We wake up and have this epiphany, which leads us to act, which leads us to become vegan. And that, my friends, is when the real journey begins. But I'll have to save that for another time. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.